Accession number 6024, reel 7.
Mr. Humphrey, reel 7. And continuing on the subject of smoking, you are a smoker yourself, so how did you cope with your needs?
Well, after a while, when ordinary supplies of cigarettes had run out completely, people discovered that the leaf of the tapioca plant belonged to the same family as the tobacco plant. It was absolutely disgusting stuff, but it was just smokable if it was dried. Well, we were growing tapioca, of course, to eat the root, because tapioca is a root crop, although in this country it's always in in seed form. But there you could dry the leaves of the tapioca and they became smokable.
Tell me how they were prepared.
Just put out in the sun and dried. That's all. It was ghastly. It was almost like smoking paper. But it was something to do, and it did to some extent, ease the pangs of hunger, I suppose. But I never myself, although I was a very addictive smoker before I was captured, and I haven't smoked now, by the way, for about 25 years, but I never smoked tobacco for food, but quite a lot of people did. And I think it was rather foolish of them.
Once dried, what would you do with the tapioca leaf?
Oh, scrunch it up into small bits and shove it in a homemade pipe. By homemade, I mean a camp-made pipe. probably made by one of the woodworkers in the camp.
Mm-hmm. Was there any kind of religious life in the camp?
Yes, there was. There were one or two people in holy orders, if that's the word for it, in the camp, including the Bishop of Labuan and Sarawak, a man named Hollis, whom I'd known quite well, and who, incidentally, 2.5 years later, officiated at my own marriage. And there was a padre from North Borneo called Collier, who was Church of England, and there was a Roman Catholic priest among the Dutch, and there were one or two Dutch monks. Exactly what order they belonged to, I don't know. But however, there were religious services were held. People attended church, if that's the word for it, occasionally, some more than others, of course. And at the end of the whole affair, the day after we were liberated and before anybody had been taken out of the camp for their final journeys homeward or anything, a quite impressive service was organised by the relieving forces in conjunction with the bishop, who gave the terminal address, and hymns were sung, and it was quite an impressive service for about an hour, with, of course, everybody then free to move around, and most people, I'm afraid, sort of thinking of those who weren't at the service and who were in the cemetery.
The routine services, were they formal, regular, and denominational?
Denominational, yes, there were, yes. There was a group of I think they were Methodists. They were, in fact, missionaries in Borneo. I think they ran a non-Church of England Christian services occasionally. The bishop and Collier ran what you'd call Church of England services, and there were Catholic services organised by this Dutch group. I can't remember whether any British Catholics who may have attended those. I don't think any of these services were massively attended, I think it would be, but there were always a sprinkling of people who went to them.
I was going to ask you whether religion seemed to play an important, a significant part in the life of the camp, as far as you could judge.
Very hard to say. With some, yes, I think. I mean, I remember there was one missionary, I think his name was Youngberg, who died in the camp, but I mean, he was, I think, a deeply religious man who had a Bible with him, and I think, read it every evening for a quarter an hour or so. Mm. There were one or two like that. But I think on the whole, we were not what I would call a churchy crowd, but people were had, well, reasonable standards and that sort of thing, and I think conducted themselves by background of what I could only call Christian ethics.
It just struck me that in view of the particularly hard conditions you were living in view of the prospects of death being much closer than it would normally be, whether these exceptional circumstances might make people turn to religion. It is conceivable, I guess.
Yes, not noticeably. I mean, except amongst those who were already what I would call people of a religious persuasion, so to speak, before they got into the camp. And there were this handful of missionaries, priests, and one or two other people who would have been regular attenders of the church wherever they lived. I think I didn't notice any noticeable movement towards that sort of attitude as time went on. I can't say, no. Perhaps one should have done, but I think the fight for survival was too intense, especially towards the end. And people largely were thinking of how to make sure they came out alive, not what their state might be in if they died.
Was there any significant contact with the outside world?
A certain amount, yes. For the earlier period that we were there, the Japanese did sometimes provide a newspaper which they were publishing in the town in Japanese, a few copies of it, and that of course had to be translated by one man, at any rate, who knew Japanese, Salu, and he just put it around what the newspaper said, but of course it was almost entirely Japanese propaganda. Every military episode described the sinking of half a dozen American aircraft carriers and further advances of the Japanese army. One never heard any news of anything except Japanese military successes and the glowing prospects of what they called the co-prosperity sphere in Southeast Asia. That happened. We did have asserters coming through from relatives inwards. I had one or two from my parents. We were allowed to send, during the time we were there, four or five postcards outwards, which we all completed. Some of them got home. Some didn't, but they were all grossly delayed. I mean, at least a year or something to get from Kuching to England. I don't know where other people were writing to. In those postcards, one had to include one or other of about six or eight prescribed sentences, which was really quite laughable. I mean, one of the sentences I recollect was to the effect that I am living in a lovely tropical conditions and only wish you were here with me. Well, most people deliberately left in the most nonsensical or inserted the most nonsensical of those sentences, knowing that the people at the other end would guess that it was being written under dictation.
These were cards prepared by the Japanese in a sort of delete as appropriate kind of way.
No, the card was a blank.
As far as any incoming or outgoing mail was concerned, how much censorship was applied?
Oh, outward, certainly 100% censorship. As far as I know, inward too. I mean, everything had been opened and resealed. I don't recollect that there were any startling omissions from the letters I had inward, or any deletions, but I think it's probably because my parents were shrewd enough not to include anything likely to be deleted. Of course, there was censorship there in too. I mean, during the war, stuff going out of England was equally censored. But I don't remember anything that I received having items cut out. I think it's more than likely that if a letter had contained anything they didn't want you to know, they would just destroy the whole letter.
Did you have any contact with relief organisations?
Yes, not directly, but the continual requests were put by the Grotar through to the Japanese that we should be put in touch with the International Red Cross. And eventually, I think it was certainly within the last year, a consignment of Red Cross parcels arrived, food parcels, with tins of food in them, etc. We never knew how much of what arrived reached us, because the stuff had been opened up and the Japanese had passed it on, and I think it's not unworthy to say that they pinched most of it themselves. But some did get through, yes. But it was really inadequate in volume to make any appreciable difference to the health of the camp, although, of course, it had a jolly good morale effect.
What sort of things did actually reach the internees?
Oh, tinned foods of one sort and another. I think nearly all tinned foods. I can't recollect. There may have been odd soap or something of that sort. I really can't say. But this was all very carefully portioned, you know.
How was that done?
There was an organisation set up by the committee. I can't remember who really exactly the detail of it, but it was divided out as fairly as it possibly could be.
Can you give me any sort of indication at all about what proportion of material actually ended up in your hands personally?
Oh, it might have been something like half a tin of baked beans and a portion of soap or something like that. I mean, there was no volume worth speaking of at all. I'm sure, in fact, that the Japanese did withhold a lot of the Red Cross material that reached them. Equally well, I'm quite sure that a whole lot that was dispatched never did reach them in Borneo. But some did, and I think it's possible that that was the main grounds for, or one of the grounds, for Takino being charged under as a war criminal afterwards. Mm. I don't think he was in charge of the receipt of that sort of stuff. And of course it had a very big market value outside the camp. Towards the end, people in the town of Kuching were virtually starving too, because the place had no supplies coming in at all, owing to military activity by the Allies eastwards along the coast. So the result was that food of any sort was skyrocketing in price, even outside our camp.
In the 4 years that you were an internee, how often did a Red Cross parcel arrive?
I certainly don't think more than twice. I can only mentally think of one occasion.
Was there ever any visits to the camp by outside non-Japanese people?
No. Mm. Not until the end.
Not until you were liberated?
Not until we were liberated. Mm.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion that there were some radios in the camp, although you couldn't recall...
A radio.
There was a radio, but you didn't know anything about the details of it.
Yeah.
How regular and what kind of news was available to you from that source?
It was very erratic. It depended on what they were able to pick up and, of course, in what language, because the one or two people who were operating it were not known to be operating it amongst anybody else in the camp. And all that was known was that there was something going on, and they would then, by word of mouth, pass it round what they could understand of what they had picked up, always trying to avoid. In fact, there was a golden rule in the camp that no name of any place should be mentioned within earshot of a Japanese guard. It was terribly risky. If he'd heard the name of a place, say, in the Solomon Islands or somewhere suddenly mentioned, he would undoubtedly have been excited and wondering what on earth people were talking about, if in fact there was any military activity going on there at about that time, of which he knew. So it was all very, very uncertain, and one We did know the Allies were coming back across the Pacific. Of course, for the first year or so that we were there, it was all going the Japanese way. I mean, they were still absorbing more and more territory in the Pacific until they got down to, what was it, close to Darwin, Australia. But then, when things started swinging against them, the most we ever knew was a vague idea of where the major naval fights were going on.
Did the Japanese ever suspect the existence of this radio?
I don't think so.
No searches?
Oh, searched. Oh, yes, yes. Searches certainly went on the whole time, but they never found it. I don't think they suspected it. I mean, it was naturally one of the completely forbidden things, or any materials for making a radio even. But they never discovered it.
So the searches were a matter of routine?
For certain things, yes, I think so. Yes. I don't think they ever conducted a search because they were specifically onto something. Yes.
How often did searches take place, and what kind of things were they looking for?
Well, maps were forbidden. They suddenly would have periods when they didn't want you to have certain things. I mean, at one stage, I remember all forbidden. I mean, just irrationally, I mean, for no reason at all, as far as I knew. And the result was that for a week or two, if you had a pencil, you didn't let anybody see it. But then that, the dislike of writing materials would gradually fade out, and gradually you could get back to normal again. But maps, writing materials, well, any sort of thing that you oughtn't to have. I mean, anything in the nature of a weapon, of course, or could be used as a weapon. I think they would just about tolerate a modest table knife, but nothing that could be used for assaulting another person with any effect. If they had seen anything which they knew must have involved a contact with the town to get into the camp, it would have caused trouble, e.g. Bottles of Asian medicines, or anything that had obviously been obtained by purchase in the town. That would have caused a furore, naturally, because they could see at once that there'd been a contact with the town. Anything which was in the camp which either they hadn't supplied or which had been not been brought in by an individual when he came in.
Mm. If such occasions, when such occasions arose, as they obviously did from time to time, was it a question of confiscation or punishment or both?
Usually both. Mm.
What kind of punishment for what kind of offence?
Well, I think a fairly small, trivial thing. The guard would just grab it and hit the person around the face or give him a kick or something of that sort. If I can't remember a really serious thing being found. Of course, there would have been a frightful shamozzle if they found anything in the nature of batteries or anything for making radio sets, but I didn't recollect they ever did. In fact, I'm sure they didn't.
Was there on Kuching any degree of interest in escape?
Amongst the camp generally, no, because everybody realised there wasn't a hope in hell of getting clear of Borneo. It is just possible that one might have escaped to get into the interior, but there would have been a heavy reward on your head. The Europeans were immediately and readily recognisable, and it was impossible almost to conceal yourself to look like an Asian. So the chances were really zero. But one or two bold spirits did make the attempt. Two young men from North Borneo tried to get away. Smallfield and Headley, their names were. They were away, I think, about a week or 10 days, but then they got picked up. I'm not quite sure whether they were betrayed or what happened. But they were put into solitary confinement for something like 6 or 9 months on a sort of diet of salt and stale rice and water or something like that. So they came back in the camp all in terrible shape. They survived, though, both of them. And I think one of the Dutchmen, I think, tried to escape. I think a man called Nimmer, K-N-I-B-B-E. But he was eventually killed by the Japs anyhow. And he was taken out of the camp for some reason or another and didn't survive. So I don't really know the full detail, but I think he had made an attempt at an escape.
Was there ever anything approaching anything as formal as an escape organisation?
No, no. It just was not possible in those circumstances. We were thousands of miles from the nearest centre of European or white civilisation. There wasn't a hope in hell of getting away. The only hope that anybody could have had would have been to have got into the interior of Borneo to be free, provided you could survive by what you could discover in the way of edible tropical fruits and that sort of thing. But clearly you would have been at risk the whole time if you saw any man.
If there were no successful escapes, was there ever any escape, as it were, through repatriation or exchange schemes?
No, and I don't think most of the people in the civilian camp in Kuching ever really hoped for exchange arrangements. None of us were diplomatic personnel. There were, so to speak, by definition, no members of a diplomatic service in what were British countries. There were no ambassadors or officials of an embassy or anything of that sort amongst our number. Mm. Those are the sort of people whom I think are normally exchanged in war or shortly after a declaration of war. But in our case, there were no such people, and I don't think anybody seriously gave it a thought. There were no prospects.
Now, liberation would obviously have been in your mind continuously since your original internment, but I wonder at what stage it began to seem a real positive possibility.
Well, I've no doubt in my own mind that it was in the spring of 1945, and to be quite specific, on Palm Sunday, on the 25th of March 45, that the whole morale of the camp was lifted because American planes, well, we guessed they were American, flew at a very great height over the camp, I think 20, 30,000 feet, only just visible, but no doubt about it, there were about six or eight of them flew over the camp on that day. Well, that was the first time any of us had seen anything in the nature of Allied military activity since we fell into Japanese hands. This had an enormous effect on the morale of the camp, and of course all sorts of immediate rumours went round that, oh, well, we'd be out in a couple of weeks and this sort of thing, which of course wasn't true. But even so, we didn't know it at the time, but it did reflect the fact that the Allies had put in landings at the northeast end of Borneo. And they did, in fact, 3 months later, put in further landings in June.
Did this event with the American aircraft going overhead have any discernible effect on the Japanese?
Oh, yes, very much so. For a long time, at first they tried to just laugh it off, no consequence, but they reissued some regulations which we had all long since forgotten about air raids and what we were to do in the event of air raids, which of course could only be by allies. And they reiterated that any planes that came over, if anything was dropped or anything of that sort, it wasn't to be touched. Or it may have been rather later they did that, because a good deal later and before the surrender, Allied planes were flying over and actually dropping leaflets and things by millions. But to start off with, it was an offence to pick up any of these leaflets. But eventually, the Japs themselves saw that the end was coming and that it didn't really pay them to be too tough.
As far as the internees were concerned, after this first event, what then happened between your leading up to your actual liberation?
Things went on the same as usual. More and more Allied aircraft started appearing and flying lower sometimes. I mean, not within very low, but still, you know, flying much lower than that first lot of high-flying bombers or whatever they were. We never really knew that the Allies had got as far as Brunei and Labuan, which they had, by June. We didn't know that. Although, in a conversation with the Japanese, I remember Le Gros Clark saying that he had asked Yamamoto whether he had inspected the camp in Kiningau, which was way up the other end of Borneo. Yamamoto was taken off guard and suddenly said he wouldn't reply. Well, it was a clever question because it disclosed that probably he was not in a position to inspect it because the Allies had recaptured it. But that alerted us to the possibility that the Allies at any rate had landed in the other end of Borneo. But we didn't know they'd landed in the Labuan, at least I'm sure we didn't until quite towards the end.
When did the possibility of liberation become a probability?
We judged it largely by the conduct of the Japanese. We had leaflets scattered on us, which were, of course, picked up and were issued by General Wootton. And they were written in Malay, intended for the local Asian population. But these said that the Japanese had surrendered, that Hirohito, the emperor, had ordered a surrender on the 15th of August or what have you. And the Japs just denied this initially and said this was not true, this was just propaganda designed to help defeat them, so to speak, that no Japanese surrendered. The idea that the emperor would order a surrender was just poppycock, and the war went on. This went on for quite a little while, but then the conduct of the Japanese really gave away the game. They got more and more, I won't say smarmy, that's not the word, but less and less concerned about looking after us. And then I think about somewhere early in September, Suga even announced that he was proposing to withdraw from taking any interest in what went on inside the camp and would hand over the administration to any personnel we wished to of our own, sort of like that.
What sort of gloss did he put on that action? We didn't say...
I don't remember, because it wasn't... It came to me second-hand, of course. He told... it wasn't Le Gros Clark then. They had already taken Le Gros Clark away, I'm afraid, and he was dead. It was Adams was then the person whom they were using to communicate with. And they offered, I think, to the officers, the British officers, whether they wished to take control of the camp area, the three or four of the more senior officers there. And in effect, there started a sort of freedom of movement between the various sections of the camp, which had never existed, of course, previously. And the Japanese, in a sense, faded out in the second week of September. When I say faded out, they faded out from inside the perimeter. They were still around the outside perimeter. And it was really quite a dangerous time because it was understood that none of us would go outside the perimeter. But on the other hand, of course, everyone was so cock-a-hoop. Everyone was just itching to walk out and go into the town or do whatever else. Mm. But
was there ever any fear of Japanese reprisals? That rather than let you be liberated, they might murder the whole camp?
Yes, oh, very much so. But we had certain suspicions. I'm glad you mentioned that. I'd forgotten it. There were various orders and instructions given which suggested they might be going to move a lot of us. We got very alarmed about this. I can't remember exactly what it was that put this into our heads, but there was quite a lot of things they were doing which made us think that perhaps they were going to shift the whole lot of us somewhere. And we subsequently discovered afterwards this was in fact true. They had a plan to withdraw up the Kuching River into the interior, taking us with them as porters, carriers, what have you, and no doubt bumping off anybody who couldn't make the journey, as indeed they had done with a very big camp at Sandakan, we discovered afterwards, where there were only a handful of survivors from something like 2,000 Australian troops who were there. So they had planned to withdraw and presumably let the Allies land on the coast and they would conduct guerrilla warfare from the interior.
Mm.
But that plan did not come off in our area. But I think it did come off in parts of North Borneo with terrible results.
Mm.
Yes, well, round about the 11th, I think it was, of September, most of us, the first we knew that we were really going to be free, was the arrival of two or three Australian soldiers at the entrance to the camp. And one of them opened up by just knocking over the Japanese guard, giving him a clout, and that was that. But we were then liberated by Australian troops carried by the American Navy.
That must have been quite an event.
Oh, it was. It was terrific. We had been half expecting it for a few days, but when it actually happened, of course, colossal. And these Australian soldiers, you know, with their digger hats and all the rest of it, came round, some of them quite openly asking us to tell them of any guards whom we particularly disliked, and they'd deal with them. Well, I think a certain amount of that went on too. And the next day, the American and Australian authorities jointly organized this religious service, which I'd already mentioned, which was held the next day.